G'day, and welcome to Follow the Money, the Australia Institute's podcast demystifying the big economic issues in Australia and putting them in plain English. I'm Ebony Bennett, Deputy Director at the Institute, and today we're bringing you more guests from our Economics of a Pandemic webinar series. The pandemic necessarily shut down whole sections of the Australian economy to protect public health. But with the cooperation and support of the public, Australia has successfully flattened the curve. And now we're opening up the economy and the government is turning its mind to how we get out of this recession. Already, Prime Minister Scott Morrison has talked about being, quote, extremely cautious about expenditure because we're experiencing record deficits in the coming years. But anyone familiar with Australian political debates will know that while we can always afford tax cuts and defence spending, somehow we can never afford to raise Newstart or build social housing because we have to live within our means and get the budget back to surplus as soon as possible.
We'll be back in the black in 2019-20.
The budget is back in the black and Australia is back on track.
And we're now back in surplus.
Budget back into a positive balance.
We'll be back in surplus for the first time in 12 years.
Can you guarantee that this surplus will eventuate?
Yeah, absolutely.
And reducing the debt.
We're turning the debt ship around.
Turning this debt ship around.
When Peter Costello and John Howard left office, there was zero government debt.
Because this country had no debt.
Government debt was rising and rising rapidly.
Net debt doubled.
Yeah, I know, because we've been in deficit.
The minister has all but conceded there will be no budget surplus this year as the economic impact of the coronavirus worsens.
I mean, hands up those who thought there was going to be a coronavirus epidemic when the budget was released last May. Of course no one did.
The impact will be more significant than the bushfires.
We're not a government that engages in extreme fiscal responses.
We will pursue growth and responsible budget management that ensure that governments live within their means.
And I'd say that not all governments do manage the economy well, and not all governments do manage budgets well.
It's rhetoric that the economists at the Australia Institute have long fought against, and that's why we were delighted to speak to Professor Stephanie Kelton about her new book, The Deficit Myth: Modern Monetary Theory and How to Build a Better Economy. She was in conversation with our chief economist at the Australia Institute, Richard Dennis. And Stephanie Kelton is a professor of economics and public policy at Stony Brook University. She's a leading expert on modern monetary theory, and she served as chief economist on the US Senate Budget Committee for the Democratic staff in 2015, and as a senior economic advisor to Bernie Sanders' 2016 and 2020 presidential campaigns. She was also recently appointed as one of eight members advising the Biden-Sanders Unity Task Force. This episode was recorded live on Wednesday, the 17th of June, 2020, and things may have changed since recording.
G'day, Stephanie. Welcome, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you both for having me. It's a real pleasure to be with you.
So I just wanted to, first of all, congratulate you on the book and ask to kick us off, why you thought it was time to write this book, and to briefly explain for perhaps people who aren't aware what exactly modern monetary theory is.
Well, yeah, sure. I mean, this book has been sort of gestating in me for a very long time. There is a friend of mine, she actually was a presidential candidate here in the US this election cycle. Her name's Marianne Williamson, and we had a couple of conversations, and she's a very successful author. And when I started talking with her about this book project, and I was sort of underway at the time, I remember she said to me, "You have to be pregnant with a book." And I thought, well, okay, I've been pregnant a really long time. So, you know, I had to essentially figure out who I wanted to write this book for. And that was a big motivation for me, that I wanted a book that would be accessible to anyone, that somebody didn't have to have any prior training in economics. In fact, it's probably helpful if you don't, because there's less that you have to undo when you read the book. But I really wanted something that would empower people, that would allow someone to pick up this book and to get all the way through it disabused of many of the notions that we pick up along the way when we listen to our politicians talk about really important issues around public policy and especially government finance. So the ways in which we are all bombarded on a near daily basis with talk of the need to put the fiscal house in order and bring budgets into balance and the virtues of budget surpluses and the dangers of budget deficits and the national debt. And, you know as well as I do how much of this goes on. And, you know, in my view and what MMT economists have been working on for a long time is to help people get a clearer understanding and to sort of, you know, I called it the deficit myth. I wish that there were just that there was just one myth that we could dispense with it and then we would be free. Unfortunately, it's that web of entangled myths that you have to very deliberately take somebody through the thinking and the workings of the monetary system. And, you know, how should we think about money and taxes and the deficit and the debt? And once you get a better handle on these things, I think the anxiety level can be reduced. And so I really do look at this book as something that not just empowers people by leveling the playing field so everybody has the right, I think, understanding, but that we can all breathe a little easier when, you know, we pick up the newspaper and the headline is screaming about record deficits or the national debt or something. And we can just kind of say, oh, I understand that in a different context. So I'm not going to feel anxiety and stress about that. And I actually can demand more of my politicians. I can demand better public policy because I'm not going to fall for the excuse that the reason that we can't, as you said, top up existing programs, provide more generous benefits where there always seems to be money for tax cuts and defense, as you said. The excuse we're given is we can't do this for other government, for other societal needs, for the economy and so forth, because we've run out of money somehow, or the deficit is the reason we can't. So that's the kind of short-ish answer to your question about why I needed to write this book.
And for, I guess, people who perhaps haven't read the book yet or aren't familiar with modern monetary theory, I was struck by your description to begin with of it as an explanation of how the economy actually works in reality.
Well, that's, I think that's the goal, right? I mean, I teach economics and I've been teaching economics for 20 years from the principles level all the way up through the PhD macro theory courses. I have been teaching this stuff. And, you know, if I were using textbooks that are the most widely adopted within the economics profession, I would be frankly embarrassed to stand up and present that material to my students, a lot of it anyway. And so, yeah, MMT is trying to, have an honest reckoning with how the economy works and how the monetary system works and how government finance and budgets work. And we want to paint a clear and accurate picture rather than abstracting away from things and pretending things, you know, work one way when we know full well that there are problems with much of the conventional thinking. So I think I owe it to my students. And I feel like if I'm going to communicate with the public about economics, then I owe it to them to try to get things right and to present an honest account of how things work.
Richard, you've also taught economics over many years. I'm sure a lot of those myths will be familiar to you as well. How does it apply in the Australian context?
Look, multiplication and addition work pretty much in every country. And really, that's what we get when we look at debts and deficits and public finances. Similar to Stephanie, having taught economics for 20 years, we all get asked the same questions all the time. And modern monetary theory, I think, actually, helps answer some of those simple questions quite nicely. But, you know, for me, I always like to put things back onto the students or to the journalists or to the politicians. And, the classic question that people struggle with, which I'd be interested in Stephanie's thoughts on, because I think modern monetary theory copes with this a bit better than average. But in Australia, we've been told for decades that the objective of public policy is to not just balance our government spending and government revenue. The objective, the stated goal of the government's policy is to have a budget surplus on average every year. Over the course of the business cycle, the government wants to run a budget surplus. Now, of course, if we do that, What it means is the government is promising to collect more in tax than it's promising to spend on health and education and other services. So it always confuses me that conservative governments in particular make this commitment in Australia. I commit to collecting more from you in tax than I will spend on you in services. Vote for me and I'll take more from you than I'll give. Stephanie, I don't know if they've made it all the way to surplus targeting in the US, but, you know, do you come across this bizarre contradiction that conservatives on the one hand say they want a small government, but in Australia they literally promise to say they commit to taxing more than they spend?
Absolutely. I mean, we haven't had a government in recent years commit to delivering a budget surplus. But the last time we had federal budget surpluses in this country was when Bill Clinton was president, and the federal government's budget was in surplus for four consecutive years, 1998 through 2001. So what you do here in the U.S. context is our Democrats hearkening back to the Clinton years and saying, man, we were so good. We are the true party of fiscal responsibility, because the last time the government's budget was put right was when we were in charge, you see. And so if you will put us back in control of the House and Senate, give us the White House, we know best how to manage the nation's finances, because we were the last party to deliver not just a balanced budget, but budget surpluses. So it's worn as sort of a badge of honor that we achieved that, I say achieved in quotation marks, that the budget went into surplus in those years. But you don't so much hear people promising to deliver a surplus again, but you do hear that sort of longing sentiment for the good old times when we were in charge and the budget was where it ought to be, you know, that sort of thing.
So why do you think that is? Like, why? So you write it in the book about the need to be fiscally responsible. But in Australia and in the US, conservative politicians typically run up much larger budget deficits. And when it comes to tax cuts, of course, you know, if a tax cut causes a budget deficit, then so be it. But if spending more on health or education or welfare causes a budget deficit, it's fiscally reckless and irresponsible. How do conservatives get away with this?
It's an excellent question. In part, I think it's because in the U.S. context, Democrats don't try to get away with it. They hold themselves to a different and they think higher standard. So they say, when we approach the budgeting process, we pay for our priorities. We pay for everything. And what that means in practice very often is that they don't get anything done, that they can't pass their legislation because they insist upon picking two fights, right? They have to, if they want to put more funding in education or healthcare or whatever it is, they pair that spending proposal with a proposal to increase tax on someone so that it is deficit neutral, so that it doesn't add to the deficit. So they say, look, we'll make public colleges and universities tuition free. And we'll pay for it with, this is one example of a candidate doing this, a tax on so-called Wall Street speculation, a financial transactions tax. And that will generate enough revenue to fully cover the cost of doing this. So not only do you have to persuade your colleagues in the House and in the Senate to vote for your spending priority, you also have to get them to vote for the tax increase so that it doesn't add to the deficit. Therein lies the problem. You got an awful lot of Democrats who have been reluctant to increase taxes. And so we get nothing. Whereas Republicans, as you point out with conservatives there, are more than happy to just pick one fight, right? Just have one battle. Go out and collect the votes for the tax cuts and be done with it and allow the deficit to increase. But at least you've accomplished your agenda. You got your tax cuts. Democrats don't want to play like that.
Yeah, it sounds very familiar. In Australia, I call it the right-wing ratchet. When times are good, cut taxes for your friends. When times are bad, cut spending on your enemies. And, you know, from the conservative side of politics in Australia, it works very well. Whenever the economy is growing and the budget deficit is shrinking or we get a surplus, they rush out and commit to permanent cuts in revenue. Last, you know, often they'll come in for years, but last for decades. But the minute the economy slows down, the minute the deficit starts to rise, they say, oh my God, there's a deficit. I have no choice but to cut spending on health, education, etc. And I think that that's one of the most powerful parts of your book is talking about this idea that we have no choice. Obviously, you write about the fact that when we understand that deficits aren't the problem, deficits are a tool that we can use, we can afford to spend money on, you know, whatever we want. So do you want to talk about that? Because I think that's one of the most exciting but one of the most confusing things for people about modern monetary theory, the idea that we can afford to do anything, but, you know, there are opportunity costs, and I think a lot of people get a bit scared hearing someone say we can afford to do anything.
Yeah, sure. So let's take just the recent example, right? Because the Republicans did pass very big tax cuts in the U.S. At the end of 2017, they rammed through these very big tax cuts for corporations, and then on the personal individual side, large tax cuts there as well. And, you know, a lot of people, including many economists who had advised previous Democratic administrations, said that if the Republicans are successful in passing these tax cuts, it's going to so increase the deficit and so add to the national debt that no future Congress will have any fiscal capacity. They won't be able to use, you know, the budget to do anything. All of that is done. And, you know, 2 years later, here we are, 3 years later, whatever it is, and the coronavirus pandemic starts. And what do we see? We see Congress immediately spring into action. Here we've had four major pieces of legislation passed. The biggest was $2.2 trillion, right? Nobody paused for a moment to argue or fight about pay-fors or, you know, where to find the money or the impact on the deficit. They simply kicked these bills through, passed them. They went to the president's desk and off we go. So what's happened is that Democrats especially have seen now, oh, it is quite easy when we prioritize something, we can just move a bill and we don't have to offset all of the spending. You know, we don't have to play in our terminology, a PAYGO game, this framework where you can't add to the deficit. So, you know, I'm fortunate in that I get to interact with members of the House and the Senate. And I, what I'm hearing is encouraging in the sense that I think, you know, you said a few moments ago that Republicans have this playbook, and every single time they run the same play. When they get an opportunity, they cut taxes massively. And then when the other party is in and the deficit begins to increase, they start cutting spending. Say, we have to cut spending, right? So the Democrats in the U.S., I think, are increasingly coming to the conclusion that they have been playing Charlie Brown to Lucy in the football for a long time, and they don't like it. And they see the other guys having a lot of fun when they have the power, you know, in the House and the Senate, and they hold the White House, they get to pass their agenda. And Democrats are sitting back now and saying, you know, when it's our turn, we want to do that. We want to be able to pass legislation and sometimes use that fiscal space that's available to us where we don't have to pick the second fight. We don't necessarily have to have the tax increase to get what we're after. So did that, Richard, did I get your question?
Oh, yeah, very much so. But that said, so the Australia Institute, it's a policy think tank. I'm an escapee from academia. I spend a lot of time in Parliament House talking to people about legislation in the same way as you do. So we don't talk much about theory at the Australia Institute. Doesn't mean we're not informed by it, but, you know, we put ideas out there for people to engage with. We put ideas out there, hopefully, that can be turned into legislation. And a lot of our effort in recent years, because we've had a Conservative government for quite some time, 7 years now, a lot of our effort has been put into stopping cuts in company taxes, stopping cuts to high-income earners, closing loopholes. Some people from a modern monetary theory perspective seem to suggest that stopping tax cuts for wealthy people is a waste of time. You know, don't you understand, Richard? We don't need the money. You know, don't you understand? So please, on behalf of modern monetary theory, are we wasting our time stopping tax cuts? billionaires?
Not at all. Not at all. I agree with you completely. That is an absolutely not just worthwhile, but I think vital effort. And, you know, I'm someone who believes that the levels of income and wealth inequality that exist today are not just corrosive to or disruptive and bad for the way our economy functions, but they are a real clear and present danger to our democracy. They're corrosive to the functioning of our democracy. These deep concentrations of wealth result in extreme power in the political over the political process. So I think we absolutely have to rebalance the distribution of income and wealth. A progressive income tax system, progressive tax policies are a good thing to pursue in and of themselves, where I think the MMT economists and probably maybe some of these followers that you're hearing from, where we get frustrated is with this often, with this insistence that we can't move forward with the left foot, the spending, unless the right foot moves in tandem, that we can bring the tax piece along with every increased dollar in proposed new spending, because what that does is it holds the progressive agenda hostage. It says, unless and until we get the votes for the closing of the tax loopholes, unless and until we can raise marginal tax rates, unless and until we can institute a wealth tax, we can't have these other things. So we let kids go hungry and infrastructure crumble, and we sacrifice, you know, on those priorities because we're afraid to move forward until we get the pay for piece. And you often can accomplish your goals without that. You can still fight that fight, but you don't have to win that fight in order to achieve other objectives.
Yeah. Well, I can assure you here at the Australia Institute, we're such fans of debt finance. I'd just like to give everyone a shout. My colleague, Dave Richardson, we've just put this paper out today. It's called Debt Won't Hurt Us. And it's making exactly the point you've just made then, that especially with unemployment rising in Australia, especially the fact Australia has some of the lowest levels of public debt in the world, some of the lowest levels of public debt in our own history, here we are in the middle of a crisis with not only rising unemployment but obvious public need for a wide range of services. It's so obvious that we have unemployed resources that can be employed pursuing important tasks. The only thing holding us back from that is fear of the debt. So, yeah, can you tell us from an MMT point of view, you know, what is debt and why shouldn't we be afraid of public debt?
Sure. So, you know, in the book, I have a whole chapter on this, and I actually called the chapter The National Debt, and then in parentheses, I said, that isn't, you know, the national debt that isn't, because I really think that so much of what's wrong with the public discourse is the words we've chosen to use to describe things. You know, you said earlier, when the government runs a surplus, why would you go out and tell the population, my goal is to reduce your financial well-being, right? To diminish the quantity of dollars in your hands. Who would do that? But the word surplus sounds good. It sounds like they're doing the right thing. And the word deficit sounds like, you know, you don't want to root for your favorite sporting team and turn on the TV and hear that, you know, your team is trailing by 7 points. And unless they overcome this deficit, they're going to lose the game. You know that a deficit is something bad, you know? And so, but we use that word, and with the national debt, we call it the debt. And immediately we personalize it. We say, well, I understand debt. Debt is when you borrow and you have to pay it back. And I know people who take on too much debt and then they can't pay it back. And then their credit scores go down and then they miss payments and then the payments get bigger, right? There are penalties and maybe they file for bankruptcy. We've all seen it happen to businesses and so forth. So we think of debt as just inherently something dangerous and, you know, something that ought to be avoided. But MMT thinks about this differently. So what we say is, let's think about what the deficit is, and then let's think about what the debt is. So if the government is running a fiscal deficit, deficit is just the difference between two numbers, right? And as you've already said, Richard, it's the differences between the number of dollars they spend into the economy and the number of dollars they subtract away by taxing them from us. So the government spends more dollars into the economy than they subtract away through taxation. We label it a deficit, but what we forget is that on the other side of their deficit lies somebody else's financial surplus. They spend 100 in and only subtract 90 away through taxation. Somebody gets 10. So now the government's deficit has supplied $10 to some part of the economy. Someone has those $10. Now the debt comes into play because the government chooses, and that word is really important. The government chooses to coordinate its deficit spending, the running of a fiscal deficit, with bond sales. So when the government budget goes into deficit, the government matches it up by selling government bonds. So in my example, the government deficit was 10. So now the government holds up bonds, says, I have 10 bonds. Who wants to buy them? The money to buy the bonds, the dollars to buy the bonds, was supplied by the deficit spending itself. Government put the 10 in, and now what it does, I mean, I'll say it like this, some people may not like it, but it's basically allowing people to trade those dollars up into a higher form, interest-bearing. Now you have interest-bearing dollars. That's government, those are government bonds, but we call it debt, and it's really nothing more than part of the net money supply, right? It's an interest-bearing form of Australian currency, if you like. It's and it's already been paid for. I mean, the bonds themselves are there because the government has already carried out the spending. So, you know, if I walk into a bank tomorrow and I sit down with the loan officer and I say, I'm here to borrow some money. And the loan officer says, oh, what do you want the money for? And I say, oh, I want to buy a car. Well, how much do you want? $35,000 or whatever. So we have a conversation and we see if I'm a good credit risk and if they want a bank wants to lend me $35,000. I go to the bank for the money because I don't have the money. I go to borrow the money because I don't have it. The federal government puts the money down on the loan officer's desk and then says, can I borrow that money? I mean, it isn't borrowing in any meaningful sense. It isn't debt in the same way that I take on debt when I borrow. It's just another way to allow people to hold their Australian dollars.
So in Australia, and I think the patterns are quite similar in the US, you know, Australia had record for our levels of debt, record levels of debt post-World War II. I think that's similar in the US. So during World War II, not many politicians that I'm aware of said, oh, I don't think we can afford to fight this war. It's getting a bit expensive. We need to worry about future generations. Why don't we just not fight the war so hard? Why don't we have some austerity in order to not just win the war now, but look after future generations? Australia came out of World War II with record levels of debt. The US came out of World War II with record levels of debt. And both in Australia and the US, and you say this in your book, you know, it's the golden years of not just prosperity, but improving the distribution of income, rolling out social and economic infrastructure. Why, just sort of changing to a different problem, why if we, for example, had a war on climate change and racked up enormous amounts of debt to not build bombs that blow things up, but build sources of energy that give us free energy for decades to come, why do we believe that incurring such debt to build something would have devastating economic consequences when history says accumulating debt to blow things up didn't even have adverse consequences? What do you think people think when they have these worries?
I think it's the D word. I think that the idea that, you know, it's the B word and it's the D word. It's the word borrowing, and it's that we are adding to something that we call the national debt. And so I think it's very difficult to communicate with the population to make the case that borrowing for the purpose of investing, when we recognize that the borrowing will increase the debt, but then we have to apologize for that and make the argument that even though we're going to do this thing that I know sounds very irresponsible and it's going to increase the debt, that really, if we think about it this way and from this angle, it's not that bad because in the past we had a large debt to GDP ratio, but we also have prosperity. That's a lot to wrap around someone in order to persuade them to kind of come in to the water is fine, everything, you know, we can make these investments. I just think it's cleaner, I guess, to just admit that the government doesn't have to borrow its own currency from anyone in order to spend. We could have the government run the fiscal deficits without adding to the debt. And I really think it's the debt piece that gives people the anxiety, because that's where the burdening of the next generation comes from. That's where the borrowing from China comes from. If you didn't insist on coordinating the deficit spending with the bond sales, then I think, you know, the level of anxiety would come way down, because people would not be bombarded with these horror stories about the national debt. Now, look, I say also in the book that the way I think of the thing we call the debt is just, it's a historical record. Okay. It keeps track of all of the prior instances in our nation's history where the government contributed more dollars to the economy than it subtracted away. It left those dollars being held by people in the form of US treasuries, in our case. That's all it is, a historical record of all the times we added more than we subtracted, and those dollars are sitting as part of someone's wealth. They're part of their savings. They're just US government bonds. That's all they are. Think of it as part of the net money supply. And I think we could start to change the conversation. But as long as we keep calling it debt, I don't know. I think it's an uphill battle.
Yeah, I've never met someone with $1 million in government bonds that feels that they've got anything other than an asset to enjoy. Look, final question from me, and then we'll turn over to some questions from the audience. But, you know, let's imagine that Joe Biden wins the next election and you win the election after that. What does an MMT policy framework look like? How would the world be a different place if people on the progressive side of politics were as enthusiastic about debt as people on the conservative side of politics? What could we do differently? What would we do differently?
Well, I think, let me start by saying I don't consider myself enthusiastic about debt per se. I'm just enthusiastic about making full use, taking full advantage of the monetary system that we have and approaching the federal budgeting process differently from the way we approach it today. I wouldn't go in to sit down and draft a budget, which of course is a moral document, with the goal being to achieve balance over the 10-year budgeting horizon. That's what we do today. Okay, we pretend when we sit and write a budget that that's the end goal, is to get the thing in balance. I would approach this very differently. I would say, let's have mission-oriented budgeting. Let's figure out what are the real problems in the economy that we have the capacity to address or solve. So if child poverty bugs me, and I think that's immoral, and we ought to be working very hard to eliminate it and drive it to zero, what are the policies that we can put into place? What are the investments we can make over time where the goal is to get child poverty rate to zero or poverty to zero? What are the things that we can do if our infrastructure is currently graded a D+ by the American Society of Civil Engineers? What if my goal was to get it up to a B+ or even an A? How much would I need to spend? What are the investments I need to make? What about climate change? What if my goal is to get to net zero in the time frame that the scientists tell us we need to move, right, expeditiously, to transform housing and agriculture and the way we generate energy and so forth? What are the, and then, you know, draft a budget, recognize that the constraints are in our real resources. There's an inflation constraint, but there's not a revenue constraint. So, and addressing inequality along the way. So do things on the tax side. But that's just sort of, I would do a lot of things, I think, and they would be bold and they would be ambitious, but they would be mission oriented. The goals would be clear so that they can be communicated to the population. People understand why the government is putting resources here, here, and here with these goals in mind. And then there's accountability. Did you succeed in bringing child poverty rates down? Did America's infrastructure grade go up and so forth?
Hmm. All right. I lied. I want to ask one last question. I mean, do you think that the purpose of the budget the budget constraint, the purpose of the fear of debt, is really just a way to impose discipline on democracy. That is, it's a way for people in power to, you know, treat the public like children and say, no, we can't afford to do that. Where can't afford has obviously got nothing to do with money or real resources. Can't afford is just code for I don't want to. But rather than confront democracy with the fact that I want to spend money on aircraft carriers and I don't want to spend money on childcare, you know, is the purpose of really talking about debt and deficits to just basically discipline the public to lower their expectations?
I couldn't have said that better than you just did. I think so. It is a protective shield that, you know, they can actually look you right in the eyes and empathize with you. They can go in front of their constituents when they return home to their districts and they attend a town hall and their constituents come and they say, Congressman X and Senator Y, why aren't you doing more to address this problem and that problem in our communities? And so when they say, oh, I know, I would love to be able, believe me, I would, but the debt and the deficit, we got to get this stuff. So I think it's like, you know, it works like a get out of jail free card for them, because to the extent that the people they're talking to don't know better and they too are afraid of the debt and the deficit, then just offering that excuse, I would love to do it, but we got this debt, and people say, oh yeah, we do, right? So we can't do anything.
Yeah, I know this because my kids have just figured out that I make up how much money they can have. They've just got old enough to figure out I invented their budget constraint. Ebony, we should probably take some questions from the crowd.
Yeah, thanks so much. And thanks to everyone. I've got lots of questions here. And just a reminder, there's a couple of people with their hands raised. And if you would like to ask a question directly to the panel, that is definitely the way to do that. I just thought I'd start with this question from Sean Carroll, given those last couple responses from you, Stephanie. Sean asks, is there a level of public debt that will hurt us? I support what you are saying, but is there a point where you do have to make cuts or rein things in? First to you, okay. Stephanie.
Thank you, Sean. Let me put my usual disclaimer out that selling bonds is optional. It is a choice the government makes. We do not have to continue adding to this thing that we unfortunately call the national debt if we don't want to. Those bonds are interest-bearing assets, right? So if you happen to be fortunate enough to have some of them, you're receiving interest payments on those. So the question for me is, you know, well, there are a number of dynamics here with respect to distributional questions and so forth. But look, if this stock of financial interest-bearing financial assets is increasing over time, and interest rates were to increase, then the interest income that is being paid to bondholders over time is also increasing. So then the questions for me, I guess, are twofold. One is, do we see a public purpose served in providing essentially, you know, a risk-free subsidy? These are risk-free assets, but you get a reward. You get interest for holding them. So do we see a public purpose served in continuing to offer bonds, pay interest, and allow people to receive interest income at the risk that they might make a lot of interest income and then spend that money back into the economy, creating some possible inflationary pressure? So the point is, could the debt get too big and could the interest payments get too big? Well, sure, but only in concert with all of the other spending that's happening in the economy. So, you know, if there is a long run debt crisis or problem, then it's the result of a long run inflation problem. If you don't see a long run inflation problem, you don't have a long run debt problem to worry about. So, you know, look at Japan, close to 250% debt to GDP ratio. They can't get inflation up to 1%. They've been battling deflationary pressures for decades. It isn't clear to me, and I don't think it's clear to any more, that there's some magical number out there where, you know, there was supposed to be a tipping point where you get into trouble. I think it comes down to inflation.
And just quickly for Australia, I mean, the question, you know, can the debt be too big? Well, the flip side of that is, can the economy be too small? You know, we know that at the moment the Australian economy is shrinking. We know from our own experience, seen in the US, seen around the world, when governments embrace austerity in response to a recession, they keep the economy growing lower for longer. And if people worry, even conservatives who worry about debt, usually talk about debt to GDP ratios. So I think, you know, we really have to, Stephanie said, there's no magic number where we should worry about debt, but we should be even more concerned about a shrinking economy. And just another plug, you know, Dave's paper up on the website today, debt won't hurt us. Go have a read about the Australian history.
Thanks, Richard. Lachlan McCall, are you on the line there?
Hi, yes, I am. Can you guys hear me?
Yes, we can. What's
terrific.
Your
great. Thanks, everyone. So my question for Stephanie is, as a young MMT economist, the most frustrating thing I hear from critics of MMT is MMT is a proposal to start printing money to pay for things. Now, as you know full well, the MMT literature, and you've written a large chunk of it, Stephanie, going all the way back to the 90s, says, no, it's a description rather than a prescription. And it's a description of the fact that currency issuing governments already right now spend by creating new money at the central bank. And when they tax, they delete old money. And that's even Olivier Blanchard, former chief economist of the IMF, admitted this in November. And this is the guy who pushed austerity in the Eurozone for the last decade. He's hardly a lefty. The recent head of the UK Central Bank, Mervyn King, said the same thing recently, where he said, MMT is nothing new. The way it works now is the government decides how much it wants to spend and the central bank prints the money. Why do you think so many, and I'll quickly just read you a quote from a very prominent Australian economist called Andrew Lee that kind of illustrates this. Why do so many mainstream economists confuse positivist or empirical economics, a description of the existing system, with normative economics or a proposal to do something new? And I'll quickly just read you a quote from a very prominent economist in the ALP.
Very quick, Lachlan.
Sorry, I do apologize. He said, on both sides of politics, there are those peddling false hopes. Adherents of MMT claim that the gap between revenue and expenditure can be bridged by printing money, a strategy they claim will have no adverse consequences. Governments that have tried to print money to cover their liabilities have learned the hard way that inflationary finance has limits. His sole reference there is the infamous Larry Summers Washington Post op-ed from last year. What are your thoughts?
Okay, well, let me start by saying that I did part of my graduate training at Cambridge University, and in my macro theory course, we used Olivier Blanchard's macro text, as so many others did, as a graduate level text. And, you know, his textbook lays out the mainstream position, which presents the argument as though governments have choices when it comes to how to finance their spending. Okay, if the government wants to spend a dollar, it can either raise taxes to get that dollar, borrow from savers to get that dollar, or the dreaded print money, right? Delta M, change the money supply. Now, this is presented as an ex ante budget constraint before the fact. If the government, so that's in the Blanchard text, right? The idea that there are three ways to pay. And what MMT shows, and you're right, I did publish on this, one of the earliest papers, maybe the earliest that I ever published, was walking through the actual monetary operations to explain how governments already actually pay for everything. And it turns out there isn't a choice to be made. There's only one way to pay. All government spending today, already and always, is carried out by the central bank, following Congress's instructions. Congress passes a bill. The bill orders up new dollars from the central bank. The central bank carries out the payments on behalf of Treasury by changing the numbers in the appropriate bank accounts. And when the central bank changes the numbers up, because the government is spending, it's effectively creating new digital dollars. So a dollar is born. That begins the life cycle of the dollar. The government's own spending gives rise to new money creation. So a dollar is born, and that dollar will travel around the economy. Some government worker gets paid, and then they buy some goods and services, and somebody else receives income, and then they turn around and spend a portion of that. This is the multiplier at work. And that dollar travels around until what? Until we send back a portion of those dollars to the government in the form of tax payments. And the tax payment is the death sentence for the dollar. So you're exactly right, Lachlan, that all government spending is carried out via new money creation and taxes, you said delete or erase, and I'm saying, you know, more brutally, kill off or is a death sentence. So the dollars are wiped off of balance sheets. They cease to exist at that point. So it's frustrating because, you know, we think we have the more accurate operational story to describe how government finance actually works and the creation and destruction of dollars as the government authorizes new payments and then collects a portion in the form of taxes. But I can't answer the question as to what motivates them to depict MMT as saying, you know, we want the government to print money. I mean, how else do they think that it could possibly work? The central bank changes the numbers in the bank account and new digital dollars are created. There should be no debate over that.
Richard, did you want to add anything to that?
Oh, look, just quickly, I think so many people carry this sort of, you know, Germany printing money and people with wheelbarrows and inflation destroying economies. I think that baggage is just sort of so deeply set in our culture. But look, my response to people is, if you're worried the government's spending too much, then wouldn't we be seeing inflation? Like, we're looking at negative inflation in Australia at the moment. So, to anyone saying, look, I think we're spending so much money, regardless of how you conceive of how the money is created, well, if you've got high unemployment and low to negative inflation, it's quite obvious that we're not spending enough. Where the money comes from is important, and economists can debate that. But if the fear of the thing we're worried about is the government spending leading to an outbreak of inflation, well, we've got the Reserve Bank telling us for years that inflation's too low.
Thank you. The next question is from Lindsay Bruce, and they ask, I think we've already touched on how do we get politicians to embrace MMT, and, you know, pushing back against that question of how do we pay for it, but also asks, how do we educate the public? So first to you, Stephanie.
Well, you could write a book. that's one of the things that I tried to do, you know, this is my attempt to communicate a lot of these ideas with, you know, a lay audience and to try to make it as accessible as possible. I would love nothing more than for somebody who reads this book to want to pass it on to somebody else and them to want to pass it on to somebody else, because, you know, that's a big part of, I think, how we begin to change the discourse. The other thing is the kind of work that you do. I mean, it is vital that you're there and you're also trying to communicate in different ways and to better educate the public through the efforts at the Australia Institute. We need journalists and reporters to have a better understanding. You know, very often, and I started doing this years ago, someone would reach out to me to try to get a quote for an article or something like that, and I would end up writing a few paragraphs for them and they would just stick it into their piece. So if you have the time and you're willing to kind of help them along, you know, they will improve over time. They've got to start asking better questions. And I just think it's, you know, activists have a role to play. You know, it's a multi-pronged, this isn't going to change easily. And I think it's going to take a lot of us just insisting. Every time somebody says, are you worried about the government deficit? I'd say, why do you want to call it a deficit? It's every bit as much a surplus as it is a deficit. So, you know, just kind of do what you can to flip the conversation in new ways, give it a new perspective. But it's not easy.
Richard, did you want to speak to that?
Yeah, just I wear multiple hats. I'm sure Stephanie does as well. But, you know, the educator in me loves to try and teach people about things and show them how they work and help people understand things better. But we have to admit that most people don't understand most of the things that they interact with. It's not just the monetary system that people don't understand. I have no idea how my iPad really works. I have no idea how my car really works. And we don't actually ask people to understand how an iPad works to use one. We don't ask them to understand really how their car works to use one. So without in any way suggesting that we shouldn't try and educate ourselves about things that are important, I think we can lower the bar a lot and make part of the task is to educate people, but part of the task is to just show people that options exist and that the people who are trying to crush those options out of debate have got something to hide. We don't always have to be right and explain everything. So as Stephanie said, you know, Japan said, debt, you know, 250% of GDP, run deficits forever, and it still has very low inflation. So we don't have to explain to everyone how everything works to be able to point to rich, successful countries and say the things they're warning about just aren't real. They're not worried about deficits. Look at Trump. The coalition government in here in Australia is not really worried about deficit. Give them a choice between a tax cut and a deficit, they'll take a deficit every single time. And yes, we should engage with people about the theory and the practice of how the monetary system works when that's the conversation other people want. But just as part of our democratic debate, we just need to be honest and say conservatives love debt, conservatives love deficits. They've never, ever said no to something they want to spend money on because of a debt or deficit. And they're not mutually exclusive, but depending on the audience, yeah, talk to people about how money works, but for other audiences, just talk about how politicians really buy it.
I just want to say, I couldn't agree with that more. I think people don't have to know how an iPad works. They don't have to know how a car works, but they have to feel safe using an iPad and safe getting in a car. Yeah. So if you know, respected public figures are around, and everybody is saying, oh, that's a great, reliable, very safe automobile, people feel comfortable and good. But if there are, you know, public faces around saying debt crisis, this and debt crisis, it creates that anxiety in people. So this paper, you should hold it up again because the title is perfectly oriented. You know, that's what people need. People need to hear enough people in positions like yours with some authority to say, hang on, this is not something you need to worry about. They don't need to go deeply investigate the national debt, but to have someone like you allaying those fears and from a position of authority is obviously very important.
Valerie Butler, we'll come to you in just a second. Can you hear me there?
Yes, I can.
Excellent. And just a reminder for everyone, we will send a link around to that paper, Debt Won't Hurt Us, as well as links to how you can by Stephanie's book when we send around the link to the video recording of this after the webinar is finished. And I just wanted to give a shout out to everyone. We're hovering around 1,000 participants today, so a huge turnout, and thank you all for coming and for your excellent questions. Valerie, what's your question for the panelists?
Ratings agencies have been the Praetorian Guard on behalf of the neoliberal economists, and to my mind have been used as a sort of like a scaffolding to sort of continuously hold up that system, despite the fact that they never saw the subprime and the financial crisis coming, but they're still trotted out there and a country's financial rating. How do we deal with that as part of the economic myth as we know it and as you've discussed today?
Valerie, that is such a cracker question, and I personally, after the GFC, couldn't believe that anyone listened to any of the rating agencies anymore, but what would I know? Stephanie, what's your response to that?
Well, it's a bit flippant, but ignore them. Ignore them. You know, you can't, first of all, again, my usual disclaimer, you can't rate bonds that don't exist. So if you don't want to have this stock, outstanding stockpile of government bonds, you don't have to issue them. But if the rating agencies want to threaten a downgrade in a credit rating or something like that, and the government's belief is that this is somehow going to undermine its capacity to borrow on the belief, wrongheaded belief, that it needs to be able to borrow in order to cover expenditures, then you have a problem. But if you're willing to just simply ignore them and say, listen, you guys did this to the US, you guys did this to Japan, you know, you downgraded Japanese government bonds to a rating below that of Botswana. So we're really not going to take you very seriously because, you know, the Japanese government is perfectly fine. You know, interest rates are right where the BOJ puts them. There's no inflation problem. You can safely ignore the chatterings of these rating agencies when the argument that they're making is that a downgrade, a threat of a downgrade, is related to the government's ability to pay. Okay? If that's the argument they're giving you, you can safely ignore that. There is no possible way that the Australian government gets into a situation where it cannot make the interest and principal payments on government bonds as they come due when those bond payments are due in a currency that you and only you can create.
Richard?
Look, agree entirely. And, you know, when we had Joe Stiglitz on a month or so ago, the same question came up and, you know, Joe's opinion, I think, was exactly the same. I agree with Stephanie. We just have to ignore them. You know, a ratings agency that, you know, talks about AAA and AA minus and all these minuscule gradations that they come up with, when, you know, let's be clear, there's not a corporate debt, a corporate bond in Australia that is safer than a bond issued by the Commonwealth government. Not a single bond. So, yeah, we talk about the risk of Commonwealth bonds. If the Australian government can't meet its liabilities, we have so much bigger problems than the interest bill. So, yeah, it's absurd. And I guess there's a good analogy here. There are judges who for years have decided who won an Oscar and who didn't. And in recent years, people have discovered that maybe that judging process was not really as representative and democratic as we might have thought. Well, guess what? The people who appointed themselves to judge fiscal responsibility aren't democratically elected. They're certainly not representative. And their track record, as you said, Ebony, is absolutely appalling. So just ignore these people.
And one final question, Stephanie, if you can keep your answer to under a minute, I would really appreciate it. Peter Martin asks, how do you answer ecologists claiming that MMT has the potential to increase the consumption of natural resources?
Well, in under a minute, it's in the book, but, you know, yeah, there it is. It's in there. Look, I think that one of the important contributions that we're making with respect to the debate over the national debt is that we don't even need to worry about the debt to GDP ratio. I think so much of the obsession around debt is bound up. I'm sorry, let me put that in different terms. So much of the growth obsession is bound up in our obsession with debt. We're afraid of the debt. And so we think that the way to get out of trouble is to grow our way out of trouble. So growth for the sake of growth becomes a policy goal, because if you drive the denominator up high enough, the ratio, the debt to GDP ratio, will come down. So I want to pay a lot of attention. When I talked about mission-oriented budgeting, I want to pay attention not just to an inflation constraint and say that the goal should be to maximize the speed at which we run our economy and use our and deplete resources, but to also recognize ecological constraints and so forth. So I talk quite a bit about it in the book.
Excellent. Well, that's a good plug there. We might wrap it up there, and I will tell people how to find it. Sorry, Richard.
Just very quickly, we shouldn't obsess about the size of the economy. We should worry about the shape of the economy. And if we grow the parts of the economy that destroy the natural environment, then growth will destroy the natural environment. If we grow the parts of the economy like the health sector, the education sector, the entertainment sector, if we grow them, they won't destroy the natural environment. So we have to look at the shape of GDP, not its size. And just a very quick plug for Stephanie's book. It really is very easy to read. My absolute favourite quote: we can't use deficits to solve problems if we continue to think of the deficit itself as a problem. Read the book.
Thanks, Richard. And thank you so much for your time, Stephanie Kelton. We really appreciate it. And congratulations on the book. I want to thank both Stephanie and Richard for their time today, and thanks also to the Economic Society of Australia for their assistance, and thank you to you all for your great questions.
This has been a special episode of Follow the Money, and we're aiming to bring you shorter but more frequent episodes during the pandemic, so please stay tuned, make sure that you're subscribed, and if you can, leave us a review. It helps other people to find the podcast. Stephanie's book, The Deficit Myth, is available in ebook format on Google Books, Kindle, Booktopia, and on the Google Play app. I think you can also get it as an audiobook. And in Australia, it's available in hard copies, Dimmicks in Sydney and Adelaide, and it will be available nationwide at all good bookshops from the 14th of July. Shipping has been delayed slightly due to COVID-19. You can check out the Australia Institute's Economics of a Pandemic webinar series at our website at tai.org.au/webinars to register. For the latest health information, you can check health.gov.au, and you can visit tai.org.au for all our latest research and content. We're on Twitter at the Oz Institute with an AUS. My Twitter handle is Ebony_Bennett with a double N double T, and Stephanie Kelton is at Stephanie Kelton. Richard Dennis is at RDNS_TAI. This episode was produced by Jennifer Macy with help from Grace Crivellero, and our theme music is by Jonathan McVeet from Pulse and Thrum. Remember, stay 1.5 metres away, keep washing those hands, and thanks for listening.